Welcome to week two of this series that I am calling Essential Dogen. Dogen, for anyone here who's quite new or here for the first time, Dogen being the 13th century Japanese monk who went to China and brought this particular style and tradition of practice back to Japan and founded Soto Zen in Japan, which then came eventually to us. I realized last week that I may have lifted that title, Essential Dogen, from a compilation of Dogen's work, edited by Kaz Tanahashi and Peter Levitt, called The Essential Dogen, Writings of the Great Zen Master. Oh, I was going to bring a copy from upstairs to show you it. It's in our Zendo library, if we ever get back there and anyone wants to borrow it. It's a good introduction to Dogen. The excerpts, they're short excerpts taken from all of Dogen's writings, and they're organized thematically under topics like practical instruction, history, gates of Dharma, philosophical view, expression. So it's good for kind of dipping your feet in to get wet in reading Dogen. But then it's also really important to read through one whole piece of Dogen's writing. If you hear me say the word fascicle, a fascicle is In traditional, sort of classical types of writings from different traditions, they're pieces that were written independently, that were then later gathered into one text. So we often call them fascicles rather than chapters, because they weren't written as chapters in Dogen's masterwork, really, called Shobo Genzo, or Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. So it's really important to pick, some of the easier, or I will say more accessible fascicles of Dogen, and read them without straining to understand, to read them almost the way you read poetry. And then it helps to have just a few little keys to kind of unlock or unpack Dogen, and that's what we do on our yearly Dogen study retreat, which will be this weekend. Michael will be leading that. So this is kind of a little warm-up to that, the Dogen Essentials. And what I had in mind when I chose that title was this question. What would I choose if I were to select passages from Dogen that would add up to be only maybe about 6 or 8 pages, but that a through text that one could chant regularly that would somehow pull together the essence of Dogen. And so I decided to focus on two texts that are very different. The first is Fukan Zazengi, or General Advice on the Principles of Zazen, which was one of Dogen's very earliest writings when he just got back from China, and he was quite a young man. He was only in his mid-20s. And many of you are familiar with this one. We do chant it during longer retreats, sesshin. And his emphasis in this text is on the oneness of practice and realization, that practice and realization are not separate, they're not connected in a linear way that we could say maybe they co-arise, practice and realization. So that's one strong emphasis. And the other is on the core practice of Zazen, which Dogen describes as non-thinking. And these are two themes that come up over and over again throughout Dogen's writings. But in this Fukan Zazengi text, Dogen makes no mention at all of how then we actualize our practice in our daily lives. no mention of the precepts, no mention of the paramitas, you know, like generosity and patience, etc. On the other hand, the other text that we're going to talk about next week and the week after is called Shushogi, the Principles of Practice and Realization. And that is a compilation of excerpts from Dogen's writing made 500 years, over 500 years after his death in 1890. And it was intended primarily to teach and instruct lay people like us, not people in living in monasteries. And it's not familiar to Western Soto Zen practitioners. It hasn't really been adopted here, probably because it doesn't say anything about Zazen. It emphasizes the practices of repentance, the precepts, bodhisattva vows, and gratitude, which were practices considered appropriate for lay people. Lay people weren't expected to do a lot of zazen or to attend sesshin, but we, you know, that's what we want. You know, we want the hardcore here in the West. We want that practice of meditation is what most people come to Zen practice to learn. So we're going to look at that text next week. But first, let's go back to Fukan Zazengi and Dogen's instructions for Zazen. And we'll pick up where we left off last week, which was what I read at the beginning of our first period, if you were here, about how to sit, right, and how to sway back and forth and take a few deep breaths. And then he says, think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This in itself is the essential art of Zazen. So I think these lines could easily be misunderstood, and they often are, I think, to mean that our minds in Zazen should be completely blank, to be completely empty of thought. Oh, sorry, Michael, could you run upstairs and get me the book that Norman's quote is in? The one you found.
Beyond Thinking.
Yeah, that. Sorry, I have this quote I really want to read you. In the meantime, this is the one that I just mentioned, The Essential Dogen. It's a small book, but it's got a lot of great short passages. And in the back, it tells you where each one is taken from. So it's in the Zendo Library. So sometimes our mind is, or maybe very, very still when we're sitting Zazen. Sometimes it's just such a relief to sit down and stop rushing about and doing things, and the mind settles down quite beautifully. Thank you. And other times, there's a lot of mental activity going on. And our practice is not to attach to either state. Here's what our teacher Norman Fisher has to say. In saying think not thinking, Dogen is talking about an alternative way to think, a way that is not enmeshed in desire and confusion, but is rather fluid and free. Usually our thought is either dull and dim or agitated. In both cases, though, it's being pushed by anxiety or desire. Does that sound familiar? Those two states? One or the other? Yeah. When we do Zazen, we let go of all this, letting thinking simply rise and fall by returning to awareness of breathing and posture. Thinking may be going on, but there's no more pushing. It's just thinking going on, not I am thinking. This kind of thinking is what Dogen means by non-thinking, thinking beyond thinking. So Dogen continues, the Zazen I speak of is not learning meditation. Huh? What he's saying is it's not a technique to get something, like better concentration at work or stress reduction. Although those beneficial effects may well occur, but Zazen practice is more vast than that. So it's okay, you know, people often come to the Zendo saying, I want to learn how to meditate to cope with stress. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a good place to start. But it's not all there is to it. Dogen says, it is simply the Dharma gate of repose and bliss, the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. It is the manifestation of ultimate reality. So when we sit, we are manifesting the ultimate reality of our being in each moment, just as we are. And when we do this, Dogen says, traps and snares can never reach it. Once its heart is grasped, you are like a dragon gaining the water, like a tiger taking to the mountains. A dragon in the water, a tiger in the mountains, is like totally in your element, right? Just completely in your element, in your life, right here and now. For you must know that just there in Zazen, the right Dharma is manifesting itself, and that from the first, dullness and distraction are struck aside. So when he says dullness and distraction are struck aside, he's referring to what are traditionally called the hindrances, right? Those mind states that obstruct the clarity of our mind. And of course, there are many hindrances. We all know them well. The five traditional ones are desire, aversion, dullness. Sometimes that one's called sloth and torpor. I love sloth and torpor. But a dull mind. And then agitation is another one, and doubt. Anybody ever had to struggle with doubt? Yeah, that's a big one. So these are all, and there are beautiful, wonderful, vivid descriptions of these hindrances, but that's not what I want to go into right now. But the point being is these hindrances arise and pass, like clouds in the sky, right? Or sometimes big, big storms. And we learn to stay steady, we learn to ride them out and not be obliterated by them. Now Dogen, when he says that Zazen is simply the Dharma gate of repose and bliss, and or repose and ease, you might be thinking, well, I don't really feel much repose and ease when I sit Zazen. What's wrong with me? But I don't think Dogen is saying we're supposed to be achieving lofty states of bliss all the time. But over time, we do come to feel more ease, a little more ease in our lives, even within the ongoing complications and messiness of this world. And we have a little more capacity to see both the suffering and the beauty in our world and our human lives. So again, I'm going to call on Norman Fisher, who talks about this being in the practice for the long haul. I mean, we are still on a long haul practicing through this pandemic, right? And so it's good to think about our practice in those terms, in terms of lifelong steady practice. Norman says, I think the real fruits of spiritual practice do not become apparent right away. If you do almost any kind of serious practice, even for a day or a weekend, you will see some powerful effects in your life. It is not at all unrealistic to think that someone can have a life-transforming experience in a short retreat, or even at a morning at church. I've seen this happen many times. But the real fruits of spiritual practice grow over longer periods of time. As you go back day after day to your cushion, through times when you like it and times when you don't like it, times when it is very difficult to keep it up, times when your soul aches so badly you can't imagine sitting there for even a single moment more, but you do it. And times when your mind is raging or your mind is so peaceful, you can't believe there could ever be a troubled moment ever again. When you experience all of this year after year on your cushion, you begin to find a deep appreciation and satisfaction in your practice and in your life. Right? So it becomes a way of living. Dogen goes on, in surveying the past, we find that transcendence of both unenlightenment and enlightenment, and dying while either sitting or standing, have all depended entirely on the strength of zazen. So he's talking here about going beyond the dualism of nirvana and samsara, enlightenment and unenlightenment, practice and realization. If we get caught up in striving for what we think enlightenment is and being frustrated that we're not there yet, we'll just create one more obstacle. One more obstacle that prevents us from seeing our true nature, Buddha nature, reflected all around us, wherever we look, in each moment. When he refers to dying while either sitting or standing, he's talking about the legendary achievements of the great Zen masters whose Zazen practice was so strong that they died sitting up in Zazen, right? Or standing. I'm not entirely sure why he felt he had to add that, but he did. But he's saying it doesn't depend. It says, dependent entirely on the strength of zazen. You know, you've got to keep in mind with this text that he was a pretty young guy. He wasn't even 30 yet. And he was just back from China. And he was really sold on zazen. And he wants to sell you on how wonderful this practice is. So just, you know, keep in mind there's some of that enthusiasm in his early writings. In addition, the bringing about of enlightenment by the opportunity provided by a finger, a banner, a needle, or a mallet, and the effecting of realization with the aid of a hosu, a fist, a staff, or a shout, cannot be fully understood by discriminative thinking. A hosu is that ceremonial fly whisk that you see us use sometimes in ceremonies. I'm not going to go over each of those examples. They all refer to stories from the koan literature, from teaching stories of enlightenment experiences triggered by a sudden sound or movement or a dramatic encounter with a Zen teacher, a little bit of Zen theater. And all he's saying here is that you cannot understand these experiences with our conventional discriminative mind and thinking. And then he continues and says, indeed, it cannot be fully known by the practicing or realizing of supernatural powers either. So, of course, in Dogen's day, supernatural powers counted for a lot more than they do now. So maybe now we'd have to say enlightenment cannot be fully known or explained by neuroscience, even. Although, you know, they're trying really hard. Dogen insists it must be deportment beyond hearing and seeing. Is it not a principle that is prior to knowledge and perceptions? So what is a principle prior to knowledge and perceptions? It's hard to even find language for what he's saying here. Pure being, consciousness, words fail. So he continues, this being the case, intelligence or lack of it does not matter. Between the dull and the sharp-witted, there is no distinction. Well, that's a little hard to take in, having been raised, as we have, in a very competitive culture. You know, being sharp or dull-witted or athletic or klutzy or talented or not, or popular or not, good-looking or not, seems to matter very much in our culture, if you take in the messages that surround us in our media. But our practice is a great leveler. We come into the zendo and we stop talking for a while. And we just sit down on that zafu and do the best we can. And I find it actually very moving. Every time we come together, you know, particularly for the longer sitting, and, you know, just some people are tentative and a little clumsy and learning how to do things. And that always just kind of breaks my heart open. And I love seeing that way that we come and practice together just as we are, you know. So Dogen just says, if you concentrate your effort single-mindedly, that in itself is negotiating the way. Practice realization is naturally undefiled. Just like when you observe a young child or a cat or your dog or birds, there's a sort of naturally undefiled way of being. Can we be like that? Can we just sit, just walk, just ring the bell, just sweep the floor, wash the dishes, give a Dharma talk, fully engaged, just this? It doesn't matter then if we're clumsy or graceful or quick or slow-witted. Each and everything we do is an offering to all beings. Dogen says, going forward in practice is a matter of everydayness. So he would very likely have been familiar with that famous koan, the story of the dialogue between Zhao Zhou and his teacher, Nanchuan, that goes like this, and many of you know it. Zhao Zhou asks his teacher, what is the way? And Nanchuan replies, everyday mind is the way. And Zhao Zhou asks, should I try to direct myself toward it? If you try to direct yourself toward it, you betray your own practice. So he's puzzled. What? How can I know the way if I don't direct myself toward it? And Nanchuan says, the way is not subject to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. Not knowing is blankness. If you reach the genuine way, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. How can this be discussed at the level of affirmation and negation? Trying to grasp knowing is delusion. Trying to hold on to not knowing is blankness, he says, right? If you truly reach the genuine way, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. So you see what much of what Dogen is saying here echoes old Nanchuan from 8th century China. Hundreds of years before that. If we strain too hard, we get in our own way. But if we're stuck in a kind of vacant non-knowing, that's not it either. Although we use that word emptiness in Zen, right? It's not a kind of blotto vacancy. It's a dynamic, bright, boundless awareness. So Dogen goes on, in general, this world and other worlds as well, both in India and China, equally hold the Buddha seal, and overall prevails the character of this school, which is simply devotion to sitting, total engagement in immovable sitting. Although it is said that there are as many minds as there are persons, they still all negotiate the way solely in zazen. So again, here he's making his sales pitch for zazen, for Zen practice. And invoking the path of this practice from China, India to China, to Japan. And then curiously, he says, why leave behind the seat that exists in your home and go aimlessly off to the dusty realms of other lands? If you make one misstep, you go astray from the way directly before you. And that one misstep is, of course, slipping into grasping or aversion. As soon as we do, we lose our way. But it may seem kind of ironic that he's telling us not to go off to dusty realms of other lands when he himself made the dangerous voyage all the way to China. But if we take this a little bit less literally, we might see ways that we're always seeking where the grass is a little greener, you know, even in our minds or in our ordinary lives. Maybe you've observed how even when you move to a new city or from the city to the country or from the country back to the city or into a new relationship or a new job, you realize you've taken the baggage of your conditioned mind along with you. After the initial excitement and novelty wears off, you find those old patterns arising again. Have you ever noticed that? It's true, though, that sometimes when we travel or make a fresh start, it is easier to let go of old patterns, habit patterns, at least for a while. Or until we return home and fall back into old ruts. Maybe that stepping away, that home leaving, that journeying out, is a way of being open to experience. It gives us that sense of aliveness that's easy to lose in our familiar everyday lives. I like to think of that way of being as the mind of a pilgrim, in search of a kind of clear seeing that's deep and wide, whether it's at home or abroad, you know. So that mind of the pilgrim is not, it's something that we can take on our travels, but it's also a way of approaching our lives with the mind of a pilgrim mind. I think our lives and our practice have a kind of cyclic quality. There are times of going out and seeing things newly and having new experiences, and times of staying put, keeping upright in our seats, cultivating home soil, times for integration and reflection. Sometimes we get to choose where we are in that cycle, and sometimes we don't, and we adapt as we have been this past year to staying in place. And we keep doing this cycle, I think, this inward, outward, such that whenever and wherever we awaken from forgetfulness, we realize our true home, as Thich Nhat Hanh says in that verse that we recite upon opening the Zendo. May we awaken from forgetfulness and realize our true home. Dogen continues, you have gained the pivotal opportunity of human form. Do not use your time in vain. You are maintaining the essential working of the Buddha way. Who would take wasteful delight in the spark from the flintstone? Besides, form and substance are like the dew on the grass, destiny like the dart of lightning, emptied in an instant, vanished in a flash. So, I think, as you may have heard in Buddhist cosmology, the human realm is considered the optimal place for spiritual practice and for awakening. As humans, we have enough self-awareness to realize that we're suffering, and to want to be free of it, and to take up the way the Buddha taught. But our lives are short, like dew on the grass or a flash of lightning. So Dogen asks us, as the poet Mary Oliver does, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? So this is the last paragraph of the Fukan Zazengi. Dogen writes, please, honored followers of Zen, long accustomed to groping for the elephant, do not be suspicious of the true dragon. Devote your energies to a way that directly indicates the absolute. Revere the person of complete attainment who is beyond all human agency. Gain accord with the enlightenment of the Buddhas. Succeed to the legitimate lineage of the ancestors' samadhi. Constantly perform in such a manner, and you are assured of being a person such as they. Your treasure store will open it of itself, and you will use it at will. So that language of the last paragraph is quite high flown, I think. But the two lines that I really love are when he tells us that we are long accustomed to groping for the elephant and not to be afraid of the true dragon. He's alluding to a well-known story, sort of a folktale, from the Nirvana Sutra, about a king who asks a group of blind men to examine an elephant and describe it to him. And apparently this story actually appears in a number of Eastern cultures in slightly different form. You've probably heard it. And the one blind man is touching the elephant's leg and says, oh, it's like an elephant's like a tree trunk. And the other, touching the elephant's trunk, says, oh, it's like a snake. And the one at the rear end, touching the tail, says, oh, an elephant is like a rope. And this is a wonderful metaphor for our always, always partial views of the world, right? We can only see through our human eyes and ears and nose. We can't smell what a dog smells or see what a bee sees. Our view is always partial and always conditioned and always subject to change. And then he tells us not to be suspicious of the true dragon. And he's referring to a Chinese story about a man who was obsessed with dragons. He had a whole collection of carved and painted dragons. Imagine his room, like a little dragon museum. But when a real dragon appeared outside his window, he fainted. He was absolutely terrified. So I think Dogen here is kind of poking at the Japanese of his time, who he saw being quite caught up with the trappings of Buddhism, you know, all the fancy gold statuary and paraphernalia, rather than the actual practice. I wonder what he would think if he could see the advertising section in Tricycle magazine, some of our Buddhist periodicals. It's so easy for our conditioned consumer mentality to extend to spiritual practice. You know, I really want that book. Or I want to listen to that next talk or podcast. Or make a trip to a famous practice center. And any of those things can be supportive of our practice. But we also have to notice how we shy away from the freedom and wonder that is right in front of us. The real dragon. Not just right before us, but in and all around us, we are the real dragon. And our practice is not so much to know that as to be that. So Dogen concludes by saying, if we fully embrace this practice, our treasure store will open and we will use it at will. Remember, dragons always have a treasure, right? What is your treasure? What treasure store will open? What do you think he means by this? I'm not going to tell you, I'm just asking. So the question remains, how do we live our practice in this everyday world of human life with all its vicissitudes? And Dogen doesn't say anything about that in the Fukan Zazengi, but he does elsewhere. And the compilers of the Shushogi, which we'll look at next week, found some those passages and that they felt would be a benefit to people living in the world outside the monastery as we are. So next week, we'll look at the Shushogi. But for now, we have time. I would like to invite you to speak with each other in small groups. And this really is part of our practice. For those of you who might not have done this much, it's not actually a discussion. You'll be in groups probably of three, and it's a practice of really speaking from your practice, speaking from the heart. You don't have to be clever or zenny or philosophical. Just respond from your heart. And then everybody else, just listen from your heart. You don't have to rehearse what you're going to say. Just trust that when it's your turn, what you need to say will come. And if it doesn't, that's okay. Just be quiet, and then the next person can go and just bow when you're finished speaking. And you'll each have 2 or 3 minutes. You'll have to self-time. In the Zendo, I would be ringing a bell. And I'd like to invite you to think about, Dogen talks about the dragon in the water, the tiger in the mountains. You know, being fully at home, right in their element. And to think about what for you, you know, has been that search for your true element, your true home. And maybe sometimes you've looked in the wrong places. Or how do you know when you're there? How would you describe your true home? Okay, just play around with those questions and those thoughts about that search. You know, the going out, the coming back, and recognizing your true home right there. Okay? So I will now divide you up into groups.